grain, dairy products that contain protein, and eggs.
So I'm curious. I mean, I'm not familiar at all with the rat and mice research that you've poured through to put this together. But in terms of clinical research, the first thing that comes to mind for me around multiple sclerosis is the studies by Dr. Swank and the Swank diet, which is really different than yours. And he was really promoting a diet with extremely low or no saturated fats. And here we have a diet which would be higher in saturated fats and low in grains. So why did you end up starting with the paleo perspective versus the Swank diet, for instance?
Well, I had been getting steadily worse. My treating neurologist told me about Dr. Ashton Embry, and it was through Embry's work that I discovered the paleo diet. Read through all the articles there, and I appreciated the rationale and decided to give it a try because it would be a more nutrient-dense diet, less inflammatory. That high-starch diet increases the risk of sugar-loving yeast and bacteria in the bowel, so you're more likely to have dysbiosis. And the grains, many of us have unrecognized food sensitivities to the protein in the wheat, rye, barley, the gluten, and which cross-react with the dairy protein casein. The other thing I disagree with Swank on is fats. The brain is 60 to 70% fat by dry weight. That myelin, the cell membranes, need saturated fat and cholesterol, which make up about 70% of the cell membrane. Then, of course, you need omega-3 and omega-6 fats as well. I designed a diet around the known metabolic needs of brain cells, which Swank did not do. It was a step forward, but I think this is a leap forward.
And do you have any reservations saying that, given that we're looking at now a very small number of people who've actually tried the diet that you're proposing?
Oh, sure. So, in the book, and I say this and I say this on my website, this is our experience, the science behind why I've designed things that I have. And then I advise people to talk to their family, talk to their doc, and personalize the recommendations. Certainly a more nutrient-dense diet is very health-promoting in that this diet is designed to be nutritionally very complete, very sound, even if it does exclude the grains and the dairy.
We're talking today to Dr. Terry Walls, the author of The Walls Protocol for Progressive Multiple Sclerosis and Other Chronic Autoimmune Conditions. So, Dr. Walls, you advocate this diet also for other chronic autoimmune conditions. Can you talk about autoimmunity and and what part of the diet you think actually addresses this phenomenon in a more general sense?
So, Dr. Fasano, autoimmunity is the immune cells losing the ability to recognize the other cells as belonging to the body or the greater self, and they begin attacking structures in the body. In the case of multiple sclerosis, it's the brain and spinal cord. In the case of lupus, it would be joints and major organs. Psoriasis, the skin. The particular organ that is attacked determines which type of autoimmune problem it is. There's some very interesting work by Dr. Fasano, who's identified the development of a leaky gut as one of the very first early steps that occur in the process of developing an autoimmune illness. And to that end, helping people recover from that leaky gut and reduce the foods that are at highest risk of causing this overly aggressive immune response will be very helpful.
So would you say then that it's possible there could be a common first trigger for one person who has Hashimoto's or rheumatoid arthritis and another who gets multiple sclerosis?
That is the theory that Dr. Fasano is advocating. It works through the zonulin, which opens up the gates in the small bowel, making the gut either leaky or not leaky.
And then would there be certain foods that would have a higher likelihood to cross-react, say, with the myelin sheaths in the brain for multiple sclerosis versus another food that might trigger an attack, an autoimmune attack on the thyroid?
Gluten and casein are likely problems, certainly for MS, and very commonly also for Hashimoto's as well. You know, in my advice, in my clinics for people with an autoimmune condition, I have a conversation, they've been suffering often for years and decades. I propose try the protocol for a month and then make your decision about, is this something you can do lifelong? It's much easier to contemplate these changes if you have a shorter time frame as sort of a trial period.
Sure, and then actually to experience the benefits if you are receiving benefits.
Correct.
And so you talk about in the Walls Protocol about the difference between a conventional approach to treating autoimmune conditions and a functional, what you call a functional approach. Can you briefly orient our listeners to the difference between
sure.
the two?
A conventional doc says, you got your autoimmune condition, we don't really know why, and the best thing we can do is suppress your immune cells so they can't attack you as vigorously. And so they'll give some type of medication to blunt those immune cells or processes. And those drugs will cost between $1,000 and $5,000, $6,000 a month. The functional medicine doc will say, let's examine how well your mitochondria are working, how well you are processing and eliminating toxins, the balance of your hormones, how well your gut is working. Do you have leaky gut? Do you likely have a problem with yeast overgrowth because of antibiotics? Did you have a family history that suggests that how you handle B vitamins might be impaired, or how you handle sulfur would be impaired, or how you process toxins would be impaired? And so they're addressing the environmental factors that contribute to disease activity. You know, it turns out that 95% of the risk for acquiring an autoimmune problem is not from your genes, but from the interaction of diet, life toxin exposure, exercise level, cortisol level, health and safety of the social and family relationships. By addressing the 95%, often you can need steadily fewer and fewer medications to control symptoms. And quite often we see in my clinical practice and other functional medicine physician practices, people are able to get off their medications for their chronic disease. Now, it takes quite a while. This is over several years.
And you say in the book that you encourage patients not to put too much weight on the name of their disease or diagnosis. What do you mean by that?
It's when we look at the basic science of the autoimmune problems, high blood pressure, mental health problems, diabetes, we see in all of them common themes. Mitochondria strain that are not working very well, nutrient deficiencies that are contributing, the problem with toxins stored in the fat in the bloodstream contributing, hormonal imbalance contributing, leaky gut contributing. So if I take a careful history on these environmental factors and teach my patient how to address all of those and improve them one by one, I find that it doesn't really matter what disease state I'm treating. The diseases improve, the need for medications improve, but more importantly, the patient's energy dramatically improves, their mood improves, they have more joy in their life, and they're really a much more functional human being.
And back to the Walls diet for a moment. You mentioned that one of the big emphases on the diet is having as nutrient dense as possible. Does that then put a lot of importance on the sourcing of one's animal protein and fat, that it's coming from wild or grass-fed sources, or that it hasn't been exposed to a lot of antibiotics?
Well, I tell people we have to work within their financial reality. So they just do the best that they can. If they are a hunter, that's fine. If they have access to organic grass-fed or wild game and fish, that is most ideal. But I'm very mindful we all have different economic means, so people are encouraged to do the best that they can given their situation.
And then with regards to the high vegetable intake, it was interesting that you discourage people from juicing, which I would think a lot of people from a convenience perspective would say, okay, I can get a lot of my vegetable intake from the day by throwing it in the blender. So tell us why that isn't the best way to do it.
If you do juicing and you extract the fiber, I see people doing a lot of juicing, extracting the fiber, drinking the juice, and then having to take a lot of fiber supplements so they can poop. The bacteria in our bowels need that fiber. So I'd rather they put things in a supercharged blender like Vitamix or HealthMaster so they get the cell walls broken, the juice, but retain all the fiber. And doing that would be fine. In fact, that's what I do every morning. I have a big smoothie with some vegetables, coconut milk, and then a protein source, and that's my typical breakfast.
And what are your thoughts for vegetarians with autoimmune conditions or with specifically with multiple sclerosis? Can they do a modified version of the Walls diet if they're concerned about their diet's effect on global warming, or maybe they have ethical concerns around the factory farming?
So I tell people that I had a vegetarian diet for 20 years, and for me, I'm quite convinced that that was part of why I became ill. Not the whole reason, but a contributing factor. And I go through the reasons why I think animal protein is beneficial. But I also respect that many people have very deeply held personal and religious beliefs that prevent them from eating meat, in which case I talk with them about how to do the Walls diet as a vegetarian and give them ways for them to assess, was the vegetarian diet part a factor in how they became ill and what they could do to reduce that negative influence.
So you do have what you would consider a less optimal but still possible way of doing the Walls diet.
Yes,
in that way.
Right. So we spoke to the vegetarian and vegans. We gave them an option and talked with ways they could make their vegetarian vegan diet more healthful and less likely to be a factor in their illness.
So tell us some of the standout supplements that you would consider with someone with an autoimmune condition, some of the more common and effective ones that you use.
Mostly it's food. I can't stress enough, food is the critical part. You want to know your vitamin D status and get that taken care of. You'd like to know your B vitamin status, folate, B12, homocysteine levels, and get that taken care of. And then I talk about ways to help sort out, are there other supplements to consider? But I also put in a caution. Once we start using supplements, we run the risk of getting our nutrients ratios incorrect. For example, if you take zinc, because you know zinc is really important for brain function, you may accidentally overshoot on the zinc and create copper deficiency and iron problems. If you take a lot of vitamin D, you have to be sure you're taking a lot of vitamin K and vitamin A and vitamin E. There's a balance, which is why food is absolutely my first choice, including liver. So I have to sell people on why I think liver is important and why I think seaweed is important.
Well, it's interesting how you must have a challenge encouraging Americans to eat organ meats when culturally it seems like that's that we're not a culture that tends to want to.
We have fallen away from that. Again, I think the most important thing is to teach people why nutrients are so important and how connected they are to our health, and then how to design a diet that gives you those nutrients. And there are several nutrients, lipoic acid, creatine, carnitine, and coenzyme Q that are particularly present in liver and hearts. So I'm a very big fan of teaching people that those things can be quite delicious, quite tasty, and they're probably the most nutrient-dense food for the dollar spent.
So tell us a little bit about the exercise that you recommend or exercise protocols, and maybe you could touch a little on electrical stimulation, which has been a part of your recovery.
Sure. So I think it's really important to do stretching, which most people have neglected. I recommend everyone start with a stretching program. We have great charts on where to get started. And then a strengthening program would be my next recommendation. We talk about balance training. And then the last thing is endurance training. But Then we talk about electrical stimulation of the muscles, where you have a handheld device, electrodes that are placed on the skin over the motor nerves that will then help those muscles contract during the exercise program. And for people who have more serious deconditioning, this is a very nice way to have the muscle build up more quickly. Because everyone has a unique damage to the spinal cord and brain, I strongly urge people to have a test session in the clinic to figure out which muscles are weak, a exercise program designed to strengthen those, and then a electrical therapy program designed to address those weak areas.
So you mentioned the electrical stimulation as part of the mm-hmm. training program for people with MS.
Yes.
I'm assuming that's something useful for people with autoimmune neuromuscular conditions, but are you also recommending that for people who have autoimmune conditions that don't involve their muscles?
So I should mention the device. I like to particularly used the device Continuum, manufactured by MP, because it was powerful, handheld, and it's for anyone who has significant deconditioning.
And what do you mean by deconditioning?
They're just not as strong. They don't have as much endurance. They can't walk as far. Their walking function is being compromised. There are studies using this now for stroke recovery, people who have been debilitated by severe heart failure, severe lung disease, rheumatoid arthritis, and, of course, my studies in MS. That this doesn't replace exercise, but it makes it easier for people to exercise, and it allows them to regrow their muscle strength more rapidly.
And what role, if any, does assessing one's exposure to toxins, pesticides or heavy metals or other things that could be either mimicking or participating in neurological symptoms?
So certainly if you're going to a functional medicine clinic, getting a toxin evaluation could be very, very helpful. In my protocols and my clinical practice, I assume that we are all toxic because it's a very toxic world that we live in. And so the Walls Protocol diet is designed to really ramp up the effectiveness of the detoxification enzymes because we just have so many chemicals that we're exposed to in our food supply, in the water, in the air that we breathe.
And so would it involve ever doing cleanses or detoxes or fasting?
I talk about the benefits of fasting. I talk about using clay, kelp, algae, and those certainly can be helpful. A cleanse, if your healthcare provider is putting you through that, I think that would be fine. I discourage the use of chelation. I think that is useful for an acute intoxication, but likely too aggressive for a chronic intoxication. I prefer a more gradual, steady approach.
And then maybe you could touch just briefly, Dr. Walls, on what you prefer to recommend in terms of stress and people with chronic autoimmune conditions. Obviously, stress, while not being the cause, is certainly going to modulate the intensity of symptoms.
Right. You want to be able to get your stress hormones back to idle. And so I explained that we have high stress will be very damaging, increasing inflammation. It's quite damaging to brain cells. And the benefits of stress-reducing activities like meditation, mindfulness, time in nature, gardening, Epsom salts baths, support groups, journaling, hunting, fishing. And that the key thing is to do something that you can enjoy and recommend that you do it twice a day, according to what activity it is that you've selected for yourself, but to do something very intentionally on a regular basis.
And so if we have listeners today with MS or other autoimmune conditions, I'm imagining you would tell them to seek out a functional medicine doctor?
Well, I would tell them that's going to be a pretty pricey option. So in my book, I outline the protocol, and I give strategies for working with your primary care doc, what labs to ask for, and to get started. And then if you don't get the response that you were looking for, then to go and pursue a functional medicine evaluation. Because what I find in my primary care clinics at the VA, we don't do a big functional medicine eval, just a primary care eval, but I do all the principles that I talk about in the book. And we have marvelous results. It's very rare that we need to send someone out to a functional medicine provider.
And you think a month is a reasonable amount of time to assess whether it's going to be the right approach?
Well, ideally I would give it 6 months before you get discouraged and say, you know, this wasn't going to help. In my clinics with my vets, I work hard at getting them to do the first month and begin the journey. But before you say, this is really not getting me far enough, and I need to see a functional medicine doc, I would give it 6 months. Unless things are going rapidly downhill,
sure.
In which case, then you'd probably want to go see the functional medicine doc right away.
And do you see this as something that can dovetail nicely with conventional interventions, or is it something that...
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
When we take people with their severe autoimmune problems, they stay on all of their drugs, even those very expensive biologic. We take care of the environmental factors using the Walls protocol. As people recover, their energy improves, and their vitality really improves. Their need for medication steadily decline. We work with a conventional medicine doc to very slowly and carefully taper their disease-modifying drugs. And we are often very successful at seeing people need fewer and fewer doses and then finally be medication-free.
Do you have a web presence you could point our listeners to?
Yes. Terry, T-E-R-R-Y, Walls, W-A-H-L-S.com. Your listeners should go there because we have a number of downloads that are the free materials that were mentioned in the book.
That's great. Well, it was a pleasure having you on Health Watch today, Dr. Walls.
Thank you very much.
We are talking today to Dr. Terry Walls, the author of The Walls Protocol, A Radical New Way to Treat MS and Other Chronic Autoimmune Conditions. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host, and next up is the rest of the Monday morning Radio Zine.
This is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is Healthcare Forum with host Roberta Hall. She's going to be talking with child therapist Peter Goodman about the emotional needs of children growing up in an increasingly chaotic and stressful society. This is part one of a two-part interview. You can hear the interview, the second part of the interview, next week. Thank you.
Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. In this series, we feature conversations with people who have special insights about health topics as diverse as environmental hazards, new and old medical treatments, and the benefits of universal health care. Sometimes we present an informal talk or even a lecture. Doing this program has enriched my life, and I hope it enriches yours. My guest today is Peter Goodman. He is a counselor. He has several degrees, but we'll talk about that in a minute. And I'm sitting right now in his office in Albany, Oregon, where he mainly counsels children. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Bobby. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what attracted you to this field in the first place, and then after that, how you became certified to do the work you do.
Oh my goodness. long answer to that, but I'll try to keep it short. Actually, probably what attracted me in a sort of roundabout way was my own childhood and the experience that I had and the sympathies I had for what I had gone through, what everybody goes through in their childhood. And I had done a number of things. I was a professional photojournalist for a while. I was a farmer for a long time. I noticed that I was really interested in nurturance and people's struggles with their lives and how they manage, and particularly children. And so in raising my own children was another source of inspiration. And then rather late in my life, in my early 40s, I got an MSW at Virginia Commonwealth University. Went to work at a public agency and realized that I really needed to further professionalize, train myself, particularly in work with children. And so I applied for and was accepted as a fellow at the Yale Child Study Center. They had a stipend for licensed clinical social workers. I took that position and stayed on to be an instructor in child psychotherapy. Then from there, I've had a number of career positions. I was in private practice. I am in private practice now. I work for public agencies. I worked in residential care. I worked in children's hospitals. So I've seen really the entire spectrum of child disturbance and the efforts to help children manage those.
One of the things I wanted to talk about was how you distinguish between the sort of normal, ordinary disturbances that all children have, and I agree with you, I can remember them certainly from my childhood as well, and how you can tell when it's something that needs maybe some really serious intervention or maybe just some counseling. How can you tell? Or is that just simply something intuitive that you simply can't describe?
Well, I think I can describe it. I feel the responsibility to make that distinction all the time. In fact, childhood is a whole series of disturbances and rebalancing the equilibrium all the way through the developmental process from early infancy right up to adulthood. And in adulthood, there are further disturbances. Now, what makes these disturbances pathological, you might say, or dysfunctional, is when they halt or impede the forward-moving developmental process. So if children are hung up on a particular developmental stage when by their age and by the expectations they're not reaching that, then there may be a problem. And it's a matter of degree also. Parents are always concerned, is this just a passing phase or not? And I'm delighted to be able to share with parents my thoughts about whether it is, in fact, just a passing stage or whether it really is somehow interfering with the child's functioning. And that really goes to the goals of therapy, which aren't so much to produce the perfect child or a child without problems, but rather a child who is on track developmentally to move forward and go through those issues in terms of their growth and development.
Well, with adults, a lot of times I know screening tools are used. People are given a piece of paper with a lot of words on it, and they describe their feelings or their reactions, or, you know, I feel depressed today on a scale of 0 to 10, or, and that's a very simple one, but that's kind of the idea as I understand it. But with children, can you do that, or do you do it by observations that parents or teachers or somebody else relays?
All sorts of information are really important to understand what's going on. I do direct diagnostic interviews with the child. I always interview the parents to get their perspective on things. Oftentimes, I consult with teachers, pediatricians, and others. However, there are certain markers, certain things that you can look for. After all, children very seldomly refer themselves. Mm-hmm. Almost always, it's parents who are troubled and troubled by their children's behavior. Usually it's a behavioral matter, where in fact, the behavior may only be a superficial symptom of deeper conflicts and processes that I've just been trained to tease out and understand, so that what might look to the parent like very disturbed behavior may in fact be something that's relatively transient. On the other hand, a child who does not present with problems may be fairly depressed, for example, or anxious, but pretty much keeps a lid on it behaviorally. Usually kids come to treatment because they have created a problem for somebody else. They don't come for, you know, a brush up on their psyche, so to speak. The matters are serious. The trouble is, many children are really not paid much attention to. And so I really support the parents who take the time and are concerned enough to seek